it's a loan that's built for investors to scale their portfolios, long-term investments. They're not going to be flipping these homes and getting in and out of them quickly. It's not a good product for that. They're going to be into them more long-term, and it gives you the ability to scale that portfolio and not worry about hitting that debt to income service ceiling. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore, and we're back with Whiskey Wednesday with my main man, Jake Sheehy.
What's happening?
What's up, buddy?
Feeling great. Great day to be alive.
Great day to be alive.
Yes, sir. You know what time it is.
Hey, I like that. I love that we start these episodes with it's a great day to be alive.
Yeah, man.
Just I love the energy.
The energy's good. Feeling good for today's episode. Fun stuff on today's
agenda.
All right,
what do we have? What do we have on the agenda today?
Okay, we got three things talking about money. We're talking about the government shutdown. We're going to talk about the housing crisis. What is it even looking like right now? What should people believe? The U.S. stock market, something happened over the weekend, crazy news. And it kind of goes back onto your point about the vulnerability and people tweeting and stuff. And then we're going to go into some really good STR stuff. So when I look at our podcast analytics, I'm seeing that tons of people want to know about financing options. They're going back and watching later episodes. So let's revisit that. Let's talk about the different kinds of loans. What does it cover? Should you pay in full? Should you do this, that? What does that look like? We'll get into what does the bio of your property need to have inside of it? Not just the title, but what does the bio say?
Okay.
And then I have a loyalty kind of Dave and Buster's idea program to run by you, see if that even makes sense or what that looks like. But first, here we go. Government shutdown. I mean, to be honest with you, it just seems weird, in my opinion, that they would shut it down. You know, I don't understand. I guess there's multiple moves behind the scenes that we don't know, or at least for me, I don't know whether it be Congress or Senate or what Trump's trying to do, if there's like a plan in place. But it just seems like maybe more of a distraction to me. And it seems that it's interesting to think that people aren't upset about it at all. You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on how much it's affecting you, whether you're upset about it. I can tell you, the government shutdown has not affected me significantly, but I'm pretty upset about it. Because I get so sick and tired of these politicians using the American people as pawns in their negotiations. Mm-hmm. And they really give two shits about them, in my opinion. Mm. Again, this is my opinion. I'm not as up to date and well read. I don't sit on Fox News or CNN daily and follow this stuff. And so on purpose, I frankly don't care about it as much, right? It's too much to take in. But I do have an opinion about these shutdowns and understanding, hey, these budgets have been passed. The continuing resolution was passed. Everything was agreed upon. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, nothing was changed in it. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden the Democrats are saying we're not paying for it because we want to negotiate healthcare and Obamacare. Yeah. Hey, listen, I think our healthcare system in the U.S. is completely broken. Yeah. It needs a complete overhaul.
Yeah.
And so I completely agree that there's those conversations need to be had, but now's not the time to, in my opinion, leverage that. There's a lot of people that are out of work, out of jobs. Mm-hmm. Some are furloughed. Those furloughed employees are going to get their back pay. Mm-hmm. But part of me is like, just don't, if you're not, go leave, you know, let TSA walk out, let the air traffic control walk out. And guess what? Everybody's affected by that. Well, and all of a sudden we're like, hey, listen, now, like I said, you know, before it kind of depends on your level of anger around this based on how much it's affecting you. If you're not getting paid and you're watching these things on the news and you watch these stupid ass politicians argue back and forth and talk over each other and nothing, it's like, how can anything get done in Washington?
Right.
It is so beyond ridiculous to me. It is such a circus that I think that, a lot of it is, I do believe a lot of this is the Democrats playing games. It was already agreed upon.
Mm-hmm.
Open it up, figure it out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's stupid. And I think I heard that they're gonna wait until they've got a No Kings protest that like half the Democrat senators are passing out flyers for and wearing shirts for. Mm-hmm. That's I think October 18th is it scheduled for, and their plan is to let that happen first in D.C. and then open up the government. I again, this is
The No Kings protest. Yep. It looks like October 18th. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And I think that they're waiting for that to happen. And then they're going to, they'll come to an agreement and open things back up. I think it's just the fact that you're, the fact that you're playing games with real people and real jobs. And I mean, I think all of us would that aren't, you know, our paycheck's not necessarily getting affected by it. You know, I'm hoping for the best for all those federal employees that have to deal with this bullshit on a regular basis.
Yeah, we're going into the third week here. So, I mean, if you're not getting paid, that's 2 weeks pay, boom, docked. So, I hope you got some kind of, and that's, for some people, that's really tough, man.
Yeah,
that's,
that is tough.
So, this whole thing is just kind of, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it seems more of like a circus or a play. This doesn't really seem, this seems like a weird way to get, if like I'm in Senate or I'm in Congress and I want something to be done and I'm a Democrat, why would I want the government to shut down? Because some people are going to get affected. Some people are going to get hurt. Why not just try and negotiate in a better way? But this seems like a weird play, some kind of act or something. And it doesn't seem right.
So it seems like to me. Yeah. It seems like they're trying to get leverage points wherever they can.
Yep.
I mean, they have, you know, you got the, obviously, President Trump's Republican. You got the Republican, you know, presidency. You've got Congress. You've got Senate majority Republicans. So maybe the Democrats are like, hey, listen, we got to use some of this as leverage to get some of the things, you know, on the table and discuss that we want discussed. I think it's a bad move personally. Don't agree with it, but we'll see what happens Washington. I don't watch it too often. So you asked me about some of these topics. I'm going to be a little, I'm going to be maybe opinionated on it. I don't know if I'm an educated opinion.
Right. I feel you. Well, okay, let's move on to something else. Let's go on to the housing then, huh?
All right.
Okay, so
that's stuff I do follow.
So here we got housing, we got interest rates, less single family homes, and prices have jumped significantly. Now, does this, I mean, when you hear something like this, does this even really affect your mindset when it comes to like short-term rentals when you're buying them? Because I ask that because some people, we've had people that do like glamping, like the really nice tent experience. Some people go really big houses with the pools and the tons of land and that kind of thing. So when you hear about like single family houses, does that really like bother you when it comes to the short-term rental side or just more of like the housing in America?
No, it does, right?
Okay.
Because, I mean, we're in the real estate market. Single family homes are typically the majority of the inventory of short-term rentals.
Okay.
So being understanding what's going on the single family home side, but also being able to understand how short-term rentals, like the one of the big arguments for a lot of areas is they don't like short-term rentals because they think it affects the housing inventory, affordable housing, all of that stuff. The reality is the numbers don't show that, right? Again, it's a bunch of talking heads that make out points and the numbers do not show that short-term rentals are actually affecting those things. So I think it is as important as an investor to pay attention to that stuff. So you can say, hey, let's actually have an intelligent conversation about this, an educated conversation on this. Yeah. Right now we're in a stage where I think the housing starts, if you pull it up, the housing starts or the permits that are pulled, the lowest since May, I think, of 2020. And we have been, under an inventory pinch for a long time on the single family home side. There is in the 70s. So when it comes to affordable housing, right, in the 70s, we were building almost 500,000 single family homes under 1400 square feet a year. Today we build 50,000 homes under 1400 square feet a year.
Yeah.
10 times less. Those are starter homes. Nobody's building starter homes anymore. Has nothing to do with us short-term renting our homes in these areas or not. It has to do with the builders aren't building those homes anymore. So the existing inventory is there for starter homes. Most of those have appreciated significantly. They're built up areas, all those different things. And so there's just not a lot of inventory when it comes to affordable housing. Now, when it comes to regular, just home starts, a lot of these builders are sitting on a decent amount of inventory. This sells, you know, they're hoping for the interest rates to spur the buyers off the fence and go get in the market and start buying up these homes. And they started anticipating that and they were building, you know, not a lot, but they were building more than they're building today. And they're sitting on some inventory. And so they're saying, hey, listen, we're going to stop building. We're gonna stop putting, building inventory. We're gonna wait for these things to kind of this market that's fairly soft. We don't want to sit on this inventory, so we're just not gonna build anymore. It just exacerbates the problem, which we've had since the Great Recession. Is we were building. I don't know if I've seen the graphs. I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but we were building a lot of homes in the mid 2000s. Then we hit that crash of 2008 and home starts dropped significantly. There you go.
I mean, that's a crazy.
We were building 2.2 million homes. That was oversupply, right? So real estate is a supply and demand issue, right? Yeah. So you need to post this on the, when you edit these on YouTube, right? So people can see this chart. The real estate is always a supply and demand. Mm-hmm. And we built a lot of supply. Mm-hmm. We had lenders that were, letting people get into mortgages that they couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. They were over lending on properties. So we had supply was way up. Demand wasn't quite there. We were allowing people to buy homes that they couldn't afford. And then all of a sudden we realized, oh man, we're way oversupplied in these markets. It dropped significantly.
Yeah.
Dropped all the way down to a low. It looks like in about 2008 or 9 of housing starts, it was about 500,000 from 2.2 million to 500,000.
Dude, that's so crazy. Wow.
And then we climbed all the way till it looks like right around that 2020. You can see the COVID drop right there.
Yeah.
But we were all the way up to about 1.6 million homes. We've been somewhere around 1.3 for the last few years, kind of up and down 1.3. It's dropped significantly because these builders are saying, hey, well, listen, right now, the market's not buying all these homes up, and which home sales are down as far as overall year over year home sales are down, but there's still a supply and demand gap.
Yeah.
And so it's going to make these proper, because in that same sentence, you said home prices are going up.
Yeah,
they are. Yeah. So home prices are going up. They hit an all time high. Let's see, the nation, particularly the West, prices hit all-time highs in the first half of 2025, driven by a long-term undersupply of homes.
Wow.
The annual rate of appreciation has been decelerating, has been slowing down. And so our annual rate of appreciation is going up. So you've got all these things, and you see these headlines. You're like, oh, appreciation is dropping from 3%. It's dropped down to 2%. Mm-hmm. And so, dropped in half. You had a 50% reduction in appreciation year over year. Mm-hmm. All those things are actually true. Housing starts are down. Home sales year over year are down. Prices keep hitting all-time highs because that supply and demand gap, there's still more demand than there is supply. And it's going to be worse if all these builders, if new home, the new home starts and permits being pulled are dropping 10 or 11, 12% year over year. And so we're going from a completion rate for the housing segment surge 6.7%. Let's see, where's that? Where does it show me that? Not mortgage rates. Does it show you what percentage decline we had in building permits being pulled? The point of it is, if it's dropping significantly, I think it was somewhere around they fell around 8 to 10%. So if that's the case, but that one's showing 3%. So let's just stay there. So it drops 3% off of 1.3 million. You end up having, you're dropping somewhere close to a million homes instead of 1.3. We lose 800 homes being built. What's going to happen is a year from now, we're going to feel the effects of that inventory squeeze again. What happens when inventory squeeze, rates are possibly down by then, and demand surges, all of a sudden home prices are going to skyrocket again, right? And so they're already going up in an environment like this. And we're still seeing positive appreciation. We're hitting all-time sales prices. That says, in first half of 2025, we're hitting all-time highs in many markets across the country, and even in this environment. So now the builders are saying, we're going to slow down building. What if rates do come down? What if we have a couple rate decreases over the next, let's say year, right? By mid-2026, all these homes that didn't get permits pulled right now, didn't hit the market because nobody built them. And a year from now, we're saying, all these consumers are saying, listen, I kind of like these rates now. I kind of like where things are at.
Yeah.
And housing is out there. The issue becomes there's nothing to sell them. Their inventory is worse than it is today. And so all of a sudden, you have a demand spike, a supply decline. So what does that do to prices?
Skyrocket.
Boom. Wow. So you have to watch that stuff. Absolutely. Wow. And so it's one of the reasons why I still like my money in real estate right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's because the value of those assets looks to be like it's going to be going up.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you know, it's lining up some of these things. And that's why it's important to watch all these things. Mm-hmm. Again, my opinion, watching right. these different right. things, thinking, okay, let's fast forward. How does this affect 6 months from now, a year from now? What does that do to different mm-hmm. things? Well, inventory wise is the only other, you know, the builders are building less. They're not building us out of our supply demand gap as it is. Mm. We almost have zero. You have such a low number of trade up buyers putting homes on the market because of where rates are at. There's a lot of buyers that normally would move up mm. buyers, right? Where you're saying, okay. hey, listen, okay. I bought my starter home. Uh-huh. I'm doing well. I've had it for 3 or 4 years. I've had an extra kid or two. I need an extra bedroom or two.
Right.
And so I'm gonna sell this home and I'm gonna trade up.
Right.
What a lot of trade up buyers have been doing over the past couple of years is they're looking at their mortgage and saying, I kind of like this 3% rate. Mm-hmm. Don't really want to jump to a 7% rate mm-hmm. or 6% rate and double my rate. So I'm gonna opt for a remodel. I'm gonna opt for an addition on my home. Might pull a home equity line out. I've got some good equity in this home. And so those homes are not hitting the market either. Mm-hmm. So my point is I'm saying, you know, so you got builders not building, you got move up buyers not putting the homes on the market. That's why these inventory levels in a lot of these markets, even though they're going up mm-hmm. and the builders have a little bit more inventory on their books and they're mm-hmm. holding that inventory for longer, mm-hmm. it's still a gap in most of these areas versus the demand. And the demand is pretty lackluster mm-hmm. at the to be nice about it right mm-hmm. now, right? The demand is, it's not like buyers are flocking to these markets. Mm-hmm. When rates start to come down, there's a lot of shadow buyers out there mm-hmm. that were move up buyers that were ready to make a move. There's a lot of first time buyers waiting to see what happens with rates. You start getting a 5 in front of those interest rates. My opinion, my mm-hmm. prediction is you're going to get a flood of buyers coming in these markets, less inventory to choose from. Then now all of a sudden you're competing on every offer. You're getting multiple offers again, right. And we have one of those scenarios where prices just skyrocket.
Wow. And okay. That was gonna be my question about what rate do you think it's gonna have to get to see that flux?
I think it gets in the fives.
Something in the fives.
Yeah, something in the fives. I think that you start getting a 5 in front of it. Anywhere 5, 5.5 would be awesome mm-hmm. if it was low fives. But I think as soon as you start getting a 5 in front of those that interest rate, you're gonna get buyers more interested in making a move.
Mm.
I think it's just a mental move too. It doesn't make that big of a difference from where they're at now to high fives. Right. But I think it's a mentally saying, I feel a little more comfortable here.
Yeah. That makes sense, especially about the move up buyers. I didn't even think about them. I just thought about people who want to start their families or get their first home, but that makes total sense. The people that are already in those homes, they're not going out of them. Wow. Okay. Okay, well, that also ties into why we like the tangible assets, you know?
I like tangible assets.
And if people aren't aware, let's just drop this bomb, okay? So this weekend, or it started on Friday.
This past weekend, Friday,
Trump made an announcement that he's going to put 100% tariff on Chinese rare earth materials, meaning everything that goes into our smartphone, into our cars, into radios, into laptops, and all kinds of things, 100% tariff. And so the stock market dropped $1.65 trillion over the weekend. The S&P 500, the NASDAQ, everything tanked, baby. Look at any charts. It's pretty wild, and it's slowly, you know, creeping back up. But it's interesting when Trump just threatens this, the stock market can drop radically. And then I believe it was today or Sunday, he said, don't worry about China, it'll be fine. And it slowly started to make its way back up. And this ties
Monday,
I had
Monday, a, he says, don't worry about China. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
And regained about 50% of the losses in a day. I mean, it's exactly it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but you know, God bless all of you who invest in stocks and everything else and crypto and mm-hmm. can handle the swings of, I would be so frustrated that mm-hmm. if I had my, you know, bulk of my assets in a vehicle that mm-hmm. was affected by a tweet or a comment, and it's affected that much. I mean, these markets are so much traded on emotion.
I know.
And the mm-hmm. fact that he can swing markets the way he does, you know, that doesn't happen with real estate and tangible assets. It just doesn't. They're not liquid mm-hmm. like that. You can't just sell them because he says that, right? Or you don't like a comment, or you do like a comment. You can't hurry and buy them, right? And so they're more. they're a more stable asset, and I like the fact that I can touch and feel it personally. But yeah, man, these stock drops, the crypto drops from comments and tweets and just different things like that. And then, you know, then that can happen Friday. Hey, I don't like what China's doing. I'm dropping 100% tariff on all these things. Boom, crashes down. On Monday, he says, man, that's not what I wanted to happen. So, hey, guys, listen, China's going to be fine.
It'll be okay.
It did literally no other explanation.
Yeah.
Don't worry about
China. Don't worry about it.
It's going to be fine. Boom. Shoots back up like 50% of the – I think the chart I saw looked like around a 50% gain back on Monday. Maybe that's just looking at just eyeballing it, that might be like a, I don't know, 35-40% back in action from the losses on.
That's crazy. it's just interesting. I mean, I believe he didn't even put the 100% tariffs. He didn't put an executive order or anything on it.
He just
posted on True Social.
He was talking about it in a month or so. Yeah.
so it just tanked. So
I think it was in next month he was going to say we're going to do that.
I think the part that when you're talking about the tangible assets that really like sticks with me, that makes the most amount of sense, is when you said that I like to be able to walk onto the land and say, like, I own this land. Like, this is my parcel. This is my acreage. This is my home. Like, that makes total sense to me, rather than something that, like, I'm just doing on my iPhone that I'm just trying to ride this wave. And it seems really interesting that, like, man, well, how do you know when to buy and sell the stocks, you know? Like, how do you – you got to be really tuned in, right, to –
or you just let it ride.
I guess you just let it ride.
Let it ride. I mean, you're going to make, you know, it's going to drop. It's going to come back. It's going to do this thing over time. I mean, I think you still have to look at it as a long-term play personally. Can you imagine? Like, I mean, he probably, a good day trader is probably makes a lot of money with a guy like Trump who you know, moves the market as much as he does.
Yeah.
You know, but you got to know what you're doing. I'm sure there's guys that make, you know, that's not me. I don't understand
that. Man, I don't. That seems very stressful, man. That seems very stressful for me.
We're watching it.
All right, so let's go into some STR stuff. That was enough of our, like, trending things. Here's our STR stuff. So we talked about financing options. A lot of people were going back and listening to these episodes. So I listed some here that I DSCR, HELOC, borrowing against your 401k, owner or seller financing, second home occupancy loan, these kinds of things. Okay. Do you have a certain place you want to start, or?
Yeah. Okay. So let's start. Let's just go through these one by one.
Okay.
And then we, depending on our time, we may cut some of that other stuff out because I think, like you said, this is important. But so you start with understanding traditional financing, which is full document loans. I'm going to go in like what, similar to just going and buying your own home. You're going to go in and show them your W-2s. You're going to tell them how much money you make. They're going to look at your credit scores. They're going to look at your debt, how much debt you have versus your income, which is called the debt to income ratio. They're going to calculate all that stuff. And they're going to say, hey, Jake, you qualify for this amount based on all the financial information you provided me. Those are traditional loans. And in the short-term rental world, a lot of people are using traditional second home loans, 10% down, kind of second home type style loans. The benefit to them is that they're the best terms, the best rates. They don't have typically prepayment penalties. They're going to be very similar to the rates and terms of a primary residence, which is favorable for us. It's the best rates we're going to get on real estate as an investor typically. And so the drawback is they're full document loans, which means you have to qualify for every single one of those. And sometimes qualifying for these types of loans can be difficult because it always feels like you have to sign over your next born child to say, hey, listen, I'm going to be responsible for this loan. So a lot of investors start there though. And what happens is you're going to max out your borrowing ability and capacity with these types of loans, because every single time you get one of those loans, now all of a sudden your debt to income ratio starts to get less favorable because now you have another obligation on your debt, right? Mm-hmm. We got by the second or third one, all of a sudden I've got a couple more obligations on my debt. Well, unless my income's going up to match that every single time, you know, ultimately I'm not going to qualify for any more loans, right? And so that's why investors will look at alternatives, and for a couple different reasons. But one of them is sometimes out of necessity, We're saying, hey, listen, I don't qualify for traditional financing with the best terms. And so we look for what is called a DSCR loan. You hear that a lot, or an asset-based loan. It's called, it stands for debt service coverage ratio loans. Mm-hmm. What that means is the lender is going to say, hey, listen, we want you to have good credit rating, Sean. We want you to be a responsible borrower. And we're going to look at your credit score for that reason. But we really care about this asset. We care about what kind of income can the asset itself make. And so in short-term rentals, that's why it's called debt service coverage ratio. They're looking for how much income is there to service the debt that they're willing to lend you on that property, right? And so usually they want to see 1.2, 1.3 times the debt service. So let's say your debt service is $100,000 every single year. And they say, okay, your debt service on this property, Sean, is $100,000 a year. We want to see and make sure that that property is making at least $120,000 to $130,000, depending on your lender, right? And so if it does, and they're comfortable with the underwriting on that, they're going to say, okay, that's what we're using to qualify as an income qualifier instead of your personal income. And so as an investor, they don't even look at my personal income. They just look and say, hey, listen, we're going to lend to this LLC. We're going to lend against this property, and we want you to sign personally for it. I don't know any of them at this stage that I found that don't have you actually sign as a personal guarantor on that loan as well. But they don't care about my ability to repay, because they're looking at the property as an ability to repay. They look at my credit score, because they're going to say, if you've got a pretty high credit score, chances are you're going to care that that property is making sure that we're getting paid too, right? And so in that scenario, though, that's the benefit, is I don't have to use my own income to qualify. The drawback is you're going to put more money down. You're going to put 25, 20, 25% down on most of these loans, and you're going to have a higher interest rate. And most of them have a prepayment penalty. So you can't refinance or sell it within 3 to 5 years, because you're going to pay, if you do, you're going to have a penalty, which is going to be a big chunk of, or it's going to be points, right? Mm-hmm. 3, 4, 5 points of this, like, which is a percentage point of the sales price, goes to the lender if you exit out of that loan sooner than you're supposed to.
Okay.
So a couple drawbacks, right? It's a loan that's built for investors to scale their portfolios, long-term investments. They're not going to be flipping these homes and getting in and out of them quickly. Mm-hmm. It's not a good product for that. Mm-hmm. They're going to be into them more long-term, and it gives you the ability to scale that portfolio and not worry about hitting that debt to income service ceiling, or lending ceiling. So then you start to talk about, where do I pull some maybe untraditional money from, right? Which is... like borrowing from your 401k, owner-seller financing, second home, or those types of loans. So let's talk about our HELOCs, right?
Okay.
A lot of people will use a HELOC for a purchase. And they'll say, hey, listen, I have these assets, a home equity line of credit I can pull on. I've got $1 million property that I own $200,000 on.
This is your personal property where you and your family already live. Yeah,
there are some investor second home HELOCs, nowhere near as common as a HELOC on your primary residence. Okay. So a lot of people own their primary residence free and clear. You know, almost 30% of people in the US own their primary residence free and clear. So there's the ability to tap into that, but there's a lot of people who have a lot of equity. They might not own it free and clear, but they might own $1 million home and have a $200,000 or $300,000 mortgage because they've been there for a while. Mm-hmm. And so there's that $600,000-$700,000 that you can go tap into and go buy a property with. Okay. The problem with HELOCs that gets a lot of people in an issue is a lot of times they will combine a HELOC with the other loans. So essentially you're using maybe a DSCR loan, and then you go tap into your HELOC for that 25% down payment or the furnishings and setup costs and everything else. All of that is okay. However, when you do that, you're 100% financing a property, right? Because that HELOC has debt service tied to it. It has a payment tied to it. It's usually a variable rate loan, and it goes up and down based on where interest rates are at and everything else. So there's an obligation there. And now you're when you're underwriting that deal, it's got to be able to cover the regular debt service, the HELOC debt service, which is 100% finance. So it's a very over leveraged type of a property. And maybe you even have furnishings and setup costs in there on a HELOC. And now all of a sudden that property, you're asking that property to do a lot to pay all that debt service. And so you really, and Can it happen? Yes. Does it happen? All the time. Mm-hmm. But you have to be very diligent about understanding what you're doing in mm-hmm. those types of scenarios, because you're over leveraging a lot of times with a HELOC. Sometimes people just use a HELOC to buy a property. You might have $1 million HELOC and you're like, hey, listen, that property's 500 grand. I'm just going to go buy it with my HELOC. Mm-hmm. Again, you're using 100% of that money, to your HELOC money, to go buy that property. It's 100% financed property. So when we talk about leveraging or over leveraging properties, sometimes mm-hmm. I see it most often when people use their HELOCs to purchase properties mm-hmm. is it's a scenario where you can over leverage at times. Mm-hmm. And you know, we don't, a lot of times they don't think about that, because they're like, well, I've got this money sitting here, I want to use it, but you're borrowing it and you have debt service tied to it. Mm-hmm. And so you need to make sure that property is not over leveraged, can handle all of that extra debt service. Mm-hmm. And then skill set as far as owner seller financing mm-hmm. is, we don't talk about this enough probably. Mm-hmm. Lots of people talk about buying property with other people's money and seller financing and creative financing, subject to wrap deals, lease options, all those different things. Mm. Amazing skill sets to learn, and every investor should have those skill sets and understand those types of deals mm-hmm. in your back pocket as mm-hmm. far as being educated on them, because when you're negotiating on a deal mm-hmm. it's always preferable to, if I can, you know, take over a loan that's at 3%, then go get a new one at 7%, or have a seller finance, you know, carry the contract for me mm. at very favorable terms. And mm-hmm. and there's, the sky is the limit on how you can negotiate these deals, how you can structure them based on a win-win for the seller, for you. There's a lot of sellers that are like, man, I don't want this big lump sum of money, because I don't want a big capital gains mm-hmm. bill right now. And mm-hmm. so they're willing to let you pay on installments, carry the note for a certain period of time, a very reasonable interest rates many times. And so there's, because we don't talk about it and teach that, there's other people who do. There's tons of books. These are not rocket science. Okay. Like, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand
okay.
how to structure an owner financing, seller mm-hmm. financing, subject to deal. They're skill sets that every investor should have, and mm-hmm. every investor should know how to negotiate them, when they should be able to use them, the benefits, the pros and cons of each of those mm-hmm. types of scenarios. So I won't dive into all of them, mm-hmm. but every investor should understand the basics of a wrap deal, a subject to deal, which are basically the same thing, a wraparound mortgage and subject to, pretty okay. much the same thing, a lease option deal, and then basic seller financing. Seller financing technically is the owner, property owner owns that property free and clear, mm-hmm. and they're going to be the bank for you, right? They're going to say, mm-hmm. hey, listen, give me 10% down, give me 5% down. Mm-hmm. I'm going to carry this note for you, and we're going to amortize it over 30 years. Like a typical seller financing deal that we've done, mm-hmm. I'll give them X amount for a down payment, mm-hmm. negotiate an interest rate. Hey, we're going to have you carry this contract for us for 5%, whatever, you know, 6%, 3%, 4%, whatever it is. We mm-hmm. negotiate an interest rate mm-hmm. over, we're going to amortize it over 30 years, but we're going to pay you off within 10 years. We're going to have a balloon payment in 10. So we can't just pay you over a 30-year period. Our payment is going to reflect a 30-year amortization, mm-hmm. but we have to pay you before that 10-year mark. Maybe it's a 5-year mark, whatever. We're going to have mm-hmm. a balloon payment at some point. So that would be a typical seller financing deal. Give mm-hmm. them some down payment money. We own the home. We're going to close on it. They become the bank. Mm-hmm. They hold the note, and mm-hmm. they're in a first lien position, just like any other mortgage would mm-hmm. be. That they're going to basically give us a mortgage on that, and then we give them that, you know, we'll execute, you know, a signed deed of trust, and they hold that.
Hmm. Okay, I got some questions for you. The first one was, since it's on fresh in my mind here, that seems really risky for the seller, no? Like, you would have to, if someone came to me and said, I want to buy your home and let's plan all this out, but I got to be the bank, that seems really risky for me, seller financing, if I'm the guy that owns a home, right? Or some people actually aren't that nervous about it. Is that not like a really risky thing?
So is it risky that they would rent you the house?
It just seems weird that they would, like, you would give me a down payment for the house, right? And then so then I give it to you.
So let's say you own a home.
Okay.
And you're saying, hey, listen, I wouldn't mind some monthly income from this property mm-hmm. instead of one big lump sum. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to decide to rent it out. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to rent it out for $1,800 a month. Mm-hmm. And you're willing to let somebody else move in your house, mm-hmm. go in, give you $1,800 a month to live there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe, like, what part are you worried about as being risky? That they're going to trash your house, that they're going to not make their payments?
That one. Okay. So I'll make the payment.
Okay, so in a lease situation, what you have to do, you have to evict somebody because mm-hmm. there's times where they don't make the payment.
Right.
You have to evict them. An mm-hmm. eviction is easier and faster in most areas than a foreclosure. Mm-hmm. If I am sell you my house, mm-hmm. You stop paying me, mm-hmm. I can foreclose on you. Mm-hmm. And so I can get you out, I foreclose, I take the property back and you're out. Wow. Takes me longer, yeah. a little bit more expensive, a little harder legally because mm-hmm. There's just more hoops. But 100% people get houses foreclosed on all the time when they don't right. make payments.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're a renter, you get evicted. So the benefit for me of carrying a contract versus not carrying the contract is I'm going to require a down payment as well. Mm-hmm. So when I lease the house to you, I'm usually maybe first and last month's rent, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to give me, you're going to give me your lease up and maybe an extra your 2 months rent mm-hmm. basically as a security deposit, right? It's not
right,
going to,
right.
When I sell you the house, mm-hmm. I'm going to ask for 10% down. I'm going to ask for maybe 15, 20% down. Who knows what it is, 5%. Okay. I'm going to get a big lump sum. Uh-huh. So you're pretty committed, right? Let's yeah. say it's $1 million house and I ask for 10%, which is on the low side of what I would ask for
yeah.
if I was the seller. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get $100,000. You're going to be making me payments all this time. Mm-hmm. You stop making me payments, you're going to lose your $100,000. I get to keep the $100,000. I'll use it for legal fees. I'll foreclose you. You're yeah. probably going to be in there for 3 to 4 months mm-hmm. before I get you out. So I'm probably going to eat another 3 to 4 months of non-payment, mm-hmm. maybe six months total before I get you totally out.
Right.
Still probably not eating too much into that $100,000.
Yeah.
And I'm still way better off ahead. I might, let's say I blew through 50,000 of that $100,000 to get you out and pay the payments and do everything I needed to do. Mm-hmm. I have $50,000 still in my pocket and I go resell it again. I require somebody else to give me another $100,000. Mm-hmm. I'll go resell it to somebody else, still make my monthly income. And so, yeah, there's the risk is, what is the worst case scenario that I have to get somebody out?
Yeah.
Am I okay with that? And if I'm not okay with that, charge more down payment and or don't do the deal.
Yeah.
But understanding that those can be very, like, there's a lot of sellers that want that. There's a lot of retired sellers that own homes and they're saying, hey, listen, I don't really need $1 million in my bank account right now. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. Mm. I'd rather take $100,000. I'd rather take this asset or this money, basically mm-hmm. this equity that I've got in this $1 million home, mm-hmm. rent the $1 million home out for X amount. I'm probably getting a, 6-7% return on that, that money that I by being the loan, mm-hmm. the banker, and go in and put it in a money market account. Maybe you're getting 4%. You're like, man, I'm doing better. I don't have a big capital gains bill right now. I can kind of defer all that stuff. And so there's a lot of benefits to a seller for those situations. Like, we always think that seller financing and that sellers wouldn't want to do it. There's a lot of benefits, and there's a lot of sellers that would prefer to do that than take one big lump sum.
Interesting. That's really interesting. Okay.
There's some sellers mm-hmm. and there's like hard money lenders do this all the time. It's called lend to own, where they basically, they're hoping you default. They're lending the money, wow. hoping that they get to resell that property or that asset a couple mm-hmm. different times. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
They
yeah.
pull it back. They foreclose yeah. on you. They pull it back. They resell it. And sometimes they'll do it on purpose for anybody that will give them that down payment money, because they know they're going to be net ahead. They're like, hey, let's collect 2 or 3 different down payments. Maybe carry a contract for people that aren't quite qualified, and they know this. I don't agree with it at all. I wouldn't do this. I think it's unethical. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. they actually give the seller financing to somebody they know is probably going to default uh-huh. based on their credit situation, based on the how much money they make or whatever else.
Yeah.
But that person was willing to give them 20% down, 15% mm-hmm. down, because they were so excited about that house. And they're like, hey, listen, they're just waiting for those payments to miss so they can foreclose and then go resell it to somebody else. There are people who, it's called lend to own. There's just those sharks out there. It's very common in the hard money world.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. In that scenario, the seller financing scenario, that would only work if that person fully owns that property, because you would want the full lump sum if you had to pay off your loan to go then also take some of that money and go buy a new house. Right?
Right.
Like if I owed $400,000, but I'm asking you a down payment of $100,000, then that doesn't work out for me. I have to get the whole chunk lump sum. So seller financing only works if you own the home or fully paid off, right?
Yes. Well, no, not always.
Okay.
Like really, okay. like, and this is where it's important for investors to go read up on these strategies a little bit, because you can combine them. Yes. True seller financing, the scenario I just told you, like they own the home free and clear, and they're like, what do I do with this? Mm-hmm. But let's say somebody has significant equity And they're like, hey, and they're willing to go into a second lien position. They're like, hey, listen, you take over, you know, we'll do a wrap or a subject to deal. Mm-hmm. And let's say I own $1 million home and I only have a $400,000 mortgage. If I'm going to try to get my equity out and do seller financing, I've got $600,000 of equity sitting there. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, listen, I'll let you take over this, the payments on the $400,000 mortgage. Mm-hmm. That's going to remain in first position. I'll go in a second position and lend you and carry that other $600,000, or maybe I do, I'll say I'll carry $500,000 and you have to give me an extra $50,000 down for me to carry the rest of that. So you combine the two strategies.
Wow.
So you have a first note and a second loan from the seller. And so, yeah, there's multiple ways to do it. And sometimes you're combining strategies.
Wow. That's interesting. Okay. Let's get into some of these questions I have.
Okay.
Okay. So we talked about, you said about like when you go to the bank for the DSCR loan, they're going to look at your debt, what you have, and your income potential. And say you're two properties in.
Yep.
And so now you have a lot of, it seems like a lot of debt. You're paying off these two properties and you have your own main residence. Is it more likely that the bank is going to say, well, no, we're not going to give you that loan for that third one. You got too much debt. Or would they do that, but it's not smart of you to do that because you have too much debt?
Well, it's all what's covering the debt. Yes, the answer is yes. The bank's going to, on a traditional loan, they're going to look at it and say,
no.
Hey, based on your income, you have a lot of debt here. I don't like the ratio, your debt to income ratio. So no, we're not going to give you that loan.
Right.
Sometimes though, now keep in mind, some property two and three, not your primary residence, but your property, other properties are investment properties.
Right.
The goal of investment properties is to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so after you start filing taxes, you're a year in, 2 years in, and you're filing taxes, and this property is servicing the debt and making you positive income, and you're paying taxes on all that extra income, that wipes out, right? So they're saying, hey, listen, now we've got that extra income, which is covering that debt service plus a little bit extra. And so the bank's going to be liking that, right? So it depends on the situation. If you just got three properties that you're just paying for,
yeah,
probably property number four is not the best option.
Okay. All right. Makes sense. Okay. Going to the next one. You mentioned they would do the underwriting, right? Like if
they being the bank.
Being the bank.
Yep.
But do they, I have no idea. Do they do, you know, our underwriting, I guess, would be different than theirs. Is there a certain kind of underwriting that they do differently than what we do? And if so, what does that look like?
Almost all of them go on AirDNA. And go into
the
Rentalizer.
The banks does.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay.
So they go on AirDNA, they go into Rentalizer, they plug it in, and they look and see what revenue projection AirDNA is making on Rentalizer. Now, good and bad, because it's not always accurate.
Okay.
And so a lot of times we know that we're going to be stricter on our underwriting and we're going to be a lot more conservative on our underwriting than what Rentalizer is probably going to show us many times. And like, we're going to be more accurate, I should say. There's times where Rentalizer shows way too low too, not just too high, but a lot of times it shows too high. And so we're going to know pretty well if the bank's going to say yes or no to these properties. And many times I'm going to say yes to it less often than the bank is going to say yes to it, for example.
Okay.
So it's very rare that the bank is going to be, which seems odd, right?
Yeah, it does.
It seems like it would be the opposite, but it's how they're doing their underwriting. I've actually been flown out to a couple different banks, spoken to their underwriting department, showing them how we underwrite, because they realize that in certain markets, in certain things that they're looking at, they're being a little bit too lenient on, you know, and a little too aggressive on the numbers that they're allowing or saying that these properties are going to make.
Interesting. Okay, next question here. What kind of bank should these people go to? Is this a credit union bank? Do you go to the big Chase, JP Morgan? Where do you go to get these kinds of loans?
Look them up. I mean, and there's a lot of local community lenders that do community. We've been seeing more and more DSCR loans from credit unions, local credit unions. These are portfolio based loans, right?
Okay.
And so traditional financing is usually going Fannie and Freddie guidelines, which are pretty much mirror each other at this stage. And so they're going to, traditional second home loans are going to have very similar terms, rates, qualification standards, like what you have to, what box you have to check and T's to cross and I's to dot, right? And so they're going to be very similar. DSCR loans are different. They're, because they're portfolio based loans, there's not just a standard out there. So I always suggest people go pick a half a dozen of them. You know, Google search them. Look for some of your local banks that are going to do it. Look for some of the lenders that are advertising DSCR loans for short-term rentals, because there are a lot of DSCR lenders that only allow or only DSCR on long-term rents, because long-term rentals are actually easier to underwrite. And so, but there's, you want to make sure that there's DSCR lenders for short-term rentals, and there's a number of them out there now.
Okay.
And you want to look at their terms, rates, deals, what they require, all those different things, because they are different across the board.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, when I get a loan, it's going to cover, it'll cover the cost of like renovations, design, the photography, all that kind of stuff, right? Or is that just for the property?
No, it's just for the property.
Just for the property.
Yeah. So the DSCR lender is only going to lend you for the property. There are a couple programs that I've seen that will allow for like a rehab, or for like construction rehab cost, if you're going to be doing some really big CapEx expenses. Rare though. And so the majority of the time they're looking at property purchase. But when you have to go in on the back end, and this is true with all of these loans, it's one of the drawbacks I say about short-term rentals, but it's also one of the biggest advantages we have if we're willing to do it correctly, is that it's fairly capital intensive on the front end, because those costs are hard to, you have to pay for those, right? I got to pay for furnishings. I got to pay for artwork. I got to pay for that, create that immersive, unique experience. This is where HELOCs come in a lot. This is where credit cards come in a lot. But again, you're paying for it on the front end.
Yeah. Okay, now I think this is my last question here. I think it's probably a dumb question, but I'm just going to go for it just in case. Say I'm a high income earner. I'm doing great. I got a lot of money in the bank saved up. Why wouldn't I just pay for the property in full instead of getting the DSCR loan or any of these other loans? Why would it be smarter? I guess the question is, would it be smarter of me to get the loan and have the monthly payment instead of paying in full? Or should I just go full out and just go buy the whole thing?
Yeah, the biggest reason is the power of leverage in real estate. And so what I mean by that is, if I buy a $500,000 property, I put $100,000 down, and I've got $100,000 of my own money. Let's say I had all $500,000 in the bank and I could have paid cash for it. Let's just take my typical scenario, the four main scenarios of where you make your money: cash flow, note pay down, appreciation, and depreciation, right? So cash flow. Let's say this property is cash flowing $5,000 a year. Or so let's say, let me back that out. If it's cash flowing $5,000 a year, that's with debt service. So in the scenario, the scenario that I put $100,000 down, and a $500,000 asset, it cash flows $5,000. I made a 5% return on that money based on after it paid management fees, debt service, and everything else, right? And so debt service on that amount of money, do a $400,000 loan at 7%. See what that is. I think it's around, I think your debt service is going to be around 30 grand a year, ish. Might be a little higher than that.
Let's see here.
Debt service, 30 year. Yeah, so $2,600 a month. So what's 2661 a month? What is that? And that's just principal and interest. But just so I can show this in my head as if I paid cash for it as well.
Let's see here. Oh wow. Okay.
No. 26 times 12.
I got you. Man, I wish I could be able to do math like that
so,
in my head.
So let me just keep going with my example. $100,000 down. So $32,000 a year is your debt service. So let's say after debt service, everything else, I make $5,000 cash flow. Great, right? And so I made a 5% return on my money. That $31,000 on or $32,000 plus the $5,000, so let's say $37,000. Do $37,000 divided by $500,000.
$37,000 divided by what was it?
By $500,000.
One, two, three.
do this. So it's a 7.4% return, right? If I pay cash.
Okay.
So let's just assume that debt service is removed. So that debt service, instead of paying a loan, it's coming back to me. So the one scenario, I made 5% on my money. If I paid cash, I made 7.4%. So I beat it when it comes to that, right? I beat my return if I paid cash. But there's other things that we have to really consider with real estate.
Okay.
And the next one, let's say, is appreciation. And this is where I'll make the point is with leverage. Let's say that property went up by 5% a year. Average appreciation across the U.S. in the last 40 years is 5% appreciation. So let's just assume 5%. My $100,000 went up by my $500,000 property went up 5%. So that went to 525. So I just made a return of 25% on my $100,000 because I leveraged it, right?
I see.
And so I made 5% return cash flow wise, 25% return appreciation wise. So I made a 30% return on my $100,000.
Wow.
From cash flow and appreciation every single year. Boom. We just keep going, right? So let's just take those two to make the point. My other scenario, I paid cash. I paid 500 grand and I made 7.4%. And then I made 5%. That property went up by 5%. So I made $25,000 there. So I only made 12.4% now. You follow me instead of 30%.
I'm following you.
Because I only made that 5% is just an even 5% on my 500 grand. It went up $25,000. So now I'm way behind the eight ball. So why not take that $500,000 and go buy five of those properties? Now, we didn't even talk about no pay down. We didn't talk about, which is free money, right? Yeah. Free equity, extra equity. And then we also didn't talk about
depreciation
taxes. So, but the point is, there's a power of leverage in real estate and why people will go borrow against for real estate, not over leverage properties, but leverage these properties because your returns are better when you've got proper money leveraged because of the appreciation side of it.
All right. That was fantastic. That was really good, man.
Okay.
Okay. So here's the deal. We're at 50 minutes. Almost a full hour into this episode.
Yeah, we're cutting the you're cutting the other ones out.
Okay. All right. So maybe come back next week for these other two.
Yeah. So we'll talk about bios. We'll talk about loyalty programs. So we'll add those to next week.
Next week.
Okay. So teaser for next week.
All right. That was it. Long episode, man. Way to break it down. That's what people are looking for. So way to break it down.
I gotta break it down a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Like actually talk about things that
break it down a little bit. You know.
We break down. We only broke down two things: the housing market.
Yeah. Well, and government shutdown. Housing market, stocks.
Well, I don't count breaking down any of the trending topics because the stuff we actually know about. So, okay, guys, we're going to wrap it up. 50 minutes in. We're almost an hour into the episode. Good job.
Yeah.
Good job. Way to stick with us. We appreciate you spending your time with us. We know it's valuable. I hope you got some value out of those conversations and breaking some of that stuff down. If you know somebody else that would like to be a part of these conversations, share the show. Those things help us a lot, and we very much appreciate it. If you have more than 30 seconds, like it or review it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. And the final, most important thing I ask you at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today to start building that life you don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends. Cheers, buddy.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.